720 WGN. Hello there. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots and lots of things to talk about. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about eclipse business and looking at some of the numbers around the eclipse. It is big business, as anyone who has tried to buy a pair of eclipse viewing glasses online can attest. Some of them are going for big, big bucks. So we're going to be taking a look at those numbers, and we're going to be talking about some workplace issues as well. But before we get to that, we're joined now by Ashley Vance, who is the business columnist, and author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, who has recently written about Planet Labs, which is a company that is sending hundreds of these low-cost satellites into orbit. So let's find out a little more about that. Ashley, hi, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk about this. Well, this is such an interesting topic. And to me, it seems like kind of this wide open space for a lot of innovation, space. A lot of people are kind of getting into that game. We've heard a lot about SpaceX on this program. We've talked about that and about how Amazon's trying to get into that game a little bit. So tell us about Planet Labs and what they're up to.
Sure. Well, yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting moment in time when the cost of getting to space is coming down, and then also kind of the things that you can do in space are changing as well. And so Planet Labs is a startup based in San Francisco. They've been around for about 7 years, and they kind of rethought the satellite. Traditional satellites are about the size of a bus. They cost $100 million up to billions of dollars, and they take many, many years to design. And Planet built a small satellite about the size of a shoebox, basically around the innards of a smartphone. They kind of took all this consumer electronics that had improved a lot and made this teeny, tiny satellite that takes pictures of the Earth.
And about how much is that costing? You were saying hundreds of millions for these traditional satellites. What's the price tag we're looking at for these smaller ones built around a smartphone?
Yeah, so these, I mean, you know, they started with this smartphone idea, and they've kind of built on it a little bit, you know, with their own technology. But they cost about $1 million versus about $300 million. And then instead of having one giant satellite taking pictures of certain bits and pieces of the Earth, what Planet does is put up hundreds of these small satellites, and they're the first company or organization ever to be able to take a picture of every spot on the Earth every single day.
Which is really, really interesting when we start thinking about it, because I think we were also fascinated when Google Earth started doing that. We were seeing the bots everywhere taking pictures, and of course there was always a funny kind of, not blooper, but, you know, something caught on film that perhaps shouldn't have been, or that was a funny moment, something like that. But this is a much more ambitious endeavor of taking a photograph of every single spot on the Earth. And so what are the business implications of what companies could do with that kind of data?
Yeah, I mean, people are starting to figure this out. There are already pretty clear business use cases. There are farmers that use this data that they monitor their crops, and you can actually even see things like the amounts of chlorophyll that's in the plants from space. And so they know when is the right time to harvest their crops, kind of the ideal time. They can get a sense of the yield of their crops just by running these calculations on these images. There's hedge funds that look at how many cars are in a Walmart parking lot during the back-to-school shopping season. And so they try to get a sense of, you know, is business up or down this year? There's other companies that look at the reserves of oil that are sitting in these huge tankers in Saudi Arabia, all over the world. And they're actually able to measure from space sort of the shadow that these tankers give off, and that lets them measure how much oil is inside of these tankers and to get a sense of, like, oil supply all around the world. And there's also humanitarian things, like you can look at the amount of deforestation, the way rivers and bodies of water are changing over time.
Fascinating. And are there any companies in particular that you found that are kind of leading that charge or really innovating with this data in a really interesting way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is really cool. So, you know, on one hand, well, there's also espionage, right? So you have the National Geospatial Agency based in D.C., which has been in charge of kind of gathering information gathered from satellites. And so they're using these new satellites to track all kinds of movements of drug traffickers or you know, what have you. There's also a company called Orbital Insight, which is based in Silicon Valley, and it's one of about a handful of startups that have started to gather this data. But they've really done some of the most impressive stuff I've ever seen. It's crazy. You can pull up a map of China, and they have this AI algorithm go over it, and it will identify what's a building, what's a road, what's a boat, what's a car, and sort of divvy everything up into different colors and then track how these things change over time. It really is, it's like having this Google for our planets where you can just sort of ask questions in a brand new way.
Sure. Super interesting. And everybody head to Bloomberg.com and take a look at this, because this is a really interesting story that you've written, Ashley, and it's got so much fascinating information in it. So everybody be sure and find it there. I'll also tweet it out so people can find it. But, you know, you mentioned AI, and that was something just recently Elon Musk was talking about as a bigger threat than we realize and a bigger threat than we think about, and was even naming off things like North Korea and said, don't worry about that, worry about AI. Can you elaborate on that part a little bit? Because I think that is a sort of a thing he said that became an aside in a very, you know, an otherwise pretty big news cycle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there seem to be kind of a couple camps yeah. on this. You know, there's kind of Elon and then guys like Bill Gates who have been pretty, they're quite afraid of where artificial intelligence technology is heading, how quickly it's progressing, and sort of this idea that it could, you know, in a few years kind of awaken and start doing things on its own that may or may not really be in humans' interest. And then you have another camp of people, sort of like Mark Zuckerberg and Larry Page from Google, who tend to be much more optimistic, and they feel like we should advance this technology as quickly as possible because it can help out humankind and do things that humans can't do. So Elon has been he's been at the vanguard of the sort of naysayers camp, but it's sort of ironic because he invests in this company called OpenAI, which is developing some of the most advanced AI technology in the world, and he uses AI software all through his Tesla cars and everything he does. And so he says this is to kind of keep an eye on where the technology is going, but he's certainly not doing anything to slow it down.
Certainly, certainly. The book is called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. And the piece, The Tiny Satellites Ushering in the New Space Revolution, you can find that on Bloomberg.com. Ashley Vance, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots of people are all about this eclipse that's coming on Monday. Of course, we're going to be looking at the weather very closely here in our area. And even though the totality path is downstate from here, you will not miss a thing if you are here, for sure. We talked with the head educator for astronomy at the Adler on the show a couple of weeks ago, gosh, maybe even a month ago already, and she was explaining how even though this is not in the full path and she'll be down in Carbondale to see the whole thing, we're still going to have about 87% coverage here. So we're not going to be gypped. We're going to still see some fine eclipse stuff. But you got to have special glasses. And they're in very, very high demand right now. After the show today, I'm going to go run around and try to find a pair. I'm going to live tweet that. And so if you have any tips for me, let me know.
I was just telling Bob I saw a pair in John Williams' office. And I was like, I could snag those. But
caper music.
With the demand that's out, though, it's not really a harmless crime. I think he'd probably be very mad.
So he would be extremely mad.
It crossed my mind, and then I was like, oh, I better not.
Better not get upset there.
Yeah.
So there's some really interesting stuff. There's companies kind of cashing in on this. One of, they range, I would say, from, okay, that's fair, to, wah. One of them, Chiquita Banana. They have partnered with Funny or Die, the comedy website, and they've been they're promoting this kind of marketing strategy. We are bananas, and they've been saying we are responsible for the eclipse. We're doing this at the moment of totality, where it will turn into a banana in the sky. I mean, because that little sliver you'll see. So they're kind of having a fun.
Oh, I like that. Yeah,
they're having kind of a fun and playful time with it. A cruise line, though, Royal Caribbean, they're offering the Total Eclipse Cruise, which starts in Orlando and then will kind of weave around through the Caribbean there, looking at, you know, they believe some really prime viewing spots. But they're calling it the Total Eclipse Cruise, and Bonnie Tyler will be on to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
That is so insane.
During the eclipse. Of course that song is going to get trotted out. Bonnie Tyler's like, this is my moment. I'm doing this.
That's so funny.
It is the first total eclipse that will be visible coast to coast from the mainland United States since 1918. So, you know, you can't blame people for jumping on board of that.
Wow, almost 100 years.
Krispy Kreme is on board. They're introducing their first chocolate glazed donut during the eclipse. People are pretty excited about that. I'm kind of a donut purist.
Huh.
Like, I'm not about that.
It's first ever chocolate glazed donut during the eclipse, but I don't. That's the thing about a lot of the stuff the companies do during it is I don't see the literal connection. It couldn't get more literal than having Bonnie Tyler on your cruise to sing Total Eclipse.
That's pretty literal.
I can see that.
Right.
But I'm interested in companies just using it as a moment that's like, oh, people are excited about something. Let's just do something. Like it doesn't have to be related. Just do anything.
Right. There's a company in Oregon. They sell they make shoes. It's like a special kind of sounds like a moccasin. It's like handcrafted. They're called Soft Star Shoes, and they're making eclipse shoes. I'm like, what? What in the world? Like, you're just okay. Let's call it. Yeah.
That wasn't my first question when I found out about the eclipses. Do I have the right footwear?
Do I have the right moccasins for this? Do I have the right moccasins for this? Yeah. There's also been a slew, not to take it off of business topics, but I'm sure you saw there was a Craigslist ad that went viral of a guy that was looking for the perfect lady.
Whoa, wow.
For that particular moment.
To enjoy the eclipse with.
And to, he believes, breed a very superior human being at that particular moment. So it was basically like, hello, I'm a stranger. Let's have children.
Wow.
Right now. That's really specific.
That's wild.
There's a lot involved in that.
I wonder, did it work out? I mean, if it went viral, there was a lot of exposure for that ad, so it reached a lot of people.
And like, for the woman, that's got to be timed right. I mean, of the what I'm sure is a small group of women willing to say yes to that, very small, that's got to be timed right for them. And you know,
I'd love to follow up. Maybe next week we'll see.
We're gonna find out what happened to that eclipse guy in Oregon. But it was a very specific ad that at first you were like, this cannot be real, no one speaks this way. But then you're like, oh no, this is getting kind of,
yeah. It's too good to not be true.
It's too good to not be true.
Yeah.
So also in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, they've got eclipse-themed booze and coffee happening. A local brewery has come up with a concoction called Eclipse Beer, and they're hosting a party in their venue in Jackson Hole. And Snake River Roasting Company, also in Jackson Hole, they have a special eclipse coffee. And sure. You got to be caffeinated. You got to have your chocolate donuts, the right moccasins. Apparently the right baby daddy in Oregon. You know, you can be all set up there. Interestingly, there's a lot of marijuana dispensaries that are kind of getting in on that too.
Yeah.
cannabis dispensaries in Oregon, certainly not shying away from eclipse promotions. One in Portland, called Oregon's Finest, has started selling a particular strain of marijuana called Moon Puppies.
Love it.
So after you get quite high, then that's when the Krispy Kreme donuts comes in and the Chiquita banana.
Sure.
That. Sure.
Is I guess Oregon's like a prime spot for viewing the eclipse, I guess so. It must be.
Yeah. There's a lot of news about Oregon. Like, there's
Say a million people are expected to visit.
Yeah. There's a couple that like built things onto their house in preparation for it because they're in the perfect spot, they believe, for viewing.
Hmm.
You know, what's going to be a bummer is if like Oregon has cruddy weather that day. It's the Pacific Northwest. It rains all the time.
And that's the question right now about Southern Illinois too, that everybody who wants to go down there.
I know. I love space kind of stuff, and I've always wanted to see a meteor shower. I've never done that. I've always wanted to see an aurora. I've never done that. Not that you could do that here, but plenty of meteor showers, like the Perseids come through. You can see that. And the combination of like light pollution usually blocks it out, but sometimes they're strong enough and you can still see them in a city. But Chicago is notorious for having cloud cover when there is a celestial event. Like the last,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know, dozen years, it's been very difficult to see anything in Chicago.
Hmm.
I've bemoaned that fact on Twitter many times.
Because otherwise you'd be really psyched about this.
Oh, I would be completely psyched. I think that stuff is so interesting.
Feeling like you're in the wrong place, yeah. I've sort of allowed that to just diminish all of my interest in this eclipse, I have to say.
Really?
I've still got time to get it back up there.
Yeah.
But
do you have glasses? Oh, no, you don't, because we were talking about the ones
right,
that you
thought
of.
Bob was saying he went to a welder this morning trying to get one of those, and Lou was talking about that earlier, too, but they were all out.
I've heard that, too. I heard you had to have level 12 and up lenses, like the darkness
that's
of the
what,
lenses.
Yeah, Bob, I don't know.
Yeah, they didn't even have any 11s. No 12s, no 13, no 14.
Yeah, I heard someone else say 14. I think the important thing is you need to look on the side of the viewing glasses to make sure that they're, I think it's ISO, but not like in the photography sense. And it's a governing body that will regulate them and make them.
I think it is the same governing body. They govern the speed of film and the darkness of lenses.
Okay.
You know, those are related. I think it is. It's a standards organization. So they come up with the standards for film speed.
We'll be looking this up.
I don't know. I don't know.
We'll be looking this up on the break, which we're going to take right now. We're going to take a break, get you the news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Still lots to do here on the back half of the program. Here in a bit, we're going to be talking about Wells Fargo. You know that there was quite a scandal that hit them a while back. So we're going to be talking about the aftermath of that because we've been keeping tabs on that. But now joining us by phone is Wall Street Journal reporter Francesca Fontana, who wrote about the changing perception of mental health days in the workplace and how some companies are really encouraging their employees to use them. Francesca, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us about this story. So break it down for us a bit, because I think, it seemed like kind of a maybe a little bit of an eye-rolly kind of thing, where almost a joke even. People were like, I'm taking a mental health day, as just kind of a shorthand for either I'm playing hooky or I'm telling the boss one thing but doing another. But it's really become a lot more something that's being taken a lot more seriously in the workplace. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there is sort of that wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'm taking mental health day, really. I'm going to, you know, go to the beach or spend time with my family. But, more and more companies are trying to destigmatize mental illness in the workplace and encourage workers who actually suffer from, you know, mental health conditions to take the time off to see a therapist or recover from an anxiety attack and feel empowered to actually be transparent about why they're taking that time off.
And as employers are doing this, well, first let me ask you, are there any big companies that we see that are kind of leading the charge in this?
Sure, yeah. Well, I know that Olarg, a software maker based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, went viral on Twitter after a woman named Madeline Parker, who has anxiety and depression, has become very outspoken in her team about her struggle with mental illness. And so when she takes mental health days, she will tell her team, and she actually had her CEO email her thanking her for her openness and sort of praising her transparency. And that tweet went viral, and it got, you know, I think about 50,000 likes on Twitter, because employees want to see, you know, more support from their managers. And there are other companies like EY and American Express and Prudential who all offer things from, you know, programs that encourage workers to check in with each other and support each other to, you know, offering employees flexible work arrangements so that they can take the time off to see a therapist in the middle of the week. Or, you know, if they have a panic attack, maybe they can go home and come in early the next day. So companies are finding ways, you know, as managers are asking people to bring their whole selves to work, you know, that's now starting to really include their mental health as well.
Sure. And I think that that transparency that you mentioned is really key there, because we've talked about this when we talked about unlimited vacation days that we saw some companies doing in Silicon Valley, or unlimited parental leave, where you can say that all day long, but unless you're setting that precedent, and unless leadership is doing it and talking about it and kind of walk in the talk, you don't see employees doing that. So I think that transparency is really key. But I have to ask, though, is this just kind of another, perhaps even a little more sinister version of golden handcuffs? I mean, if we're having, you know, major mental health issues in the workplace, rather than applying, you know, like how you had written in the piece, how American Express was offering on-site mental health care rather than, you know, is this kind of a Band-Aid for something maybe a bit larger about workplace culture, that maybe it's hurting us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, well, what's interesting is that, you know, it's still something that so many employees feel the need to keep secret, even despite all of these things, kind of like you were saying with American Express's, you know, employee assistance program. Despite these programs, a lot of workers still feel that there's enough of a stigma that, you know, they're afraid to tell their workers. You know, I cited, there's a 2014 survey by a market research firm that found that 73% of workers with depression hadn't told their employer about their diagnosis. And half of those said that they thought, you know, telling their boss might put their job at risk. You know, they didn't want to risk losing their job.
Yeah, I mean, I think the destigmatizing mental illness is really, really important. And it's important to do it in a lot of different ways. I think there's no one silver bullet that fixes all of that. And I think even just bringing a more open environment to the workplace is but a step. I do wonder if maybe it is also a tell of kind of the moment that we're in, of being hyper connected. And, you know, I love technology as much as anybody, but you know, it can be overwhelming on some days. You know? So I do wonder about that part too. Are there any companies that are doing something really, really creative around this, or something kind of different and interesting that you found in reporting this story?
Well, I found that, you know, something that's becoming more common is simply eliminating the need to explain whether you're taking time off for, you know, an illness like a sick day, or a vacation day, by simply offering flexible pay time off, because that sort of eliminates the need to say why you're leaving. You're just taking time off. And I spoke to consultants and companies who think this is a good way to encourage employees to take time off for their mental health without worrying, you know, oh, do I have to make up a physical illness if I'm going to take a sick day, you know, something like that. But what I think is really interesting about what Olark's Madeline Parker did is that it wasn't just that she was taking the time off for mental health, but she was really transparent about, you know, here's what I'm doing and here's why. And that's in no way required. You know, when you take a mental health day, you don't have to list your entire personal medical history. But she's doing it in order to make the point that, you know, one in five adults in the U.S. has a mental health condition, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So, you know, it might be more common than people realize.
Definitely. Well, thank you for joining us and breaking all of this down for us, Francesca Fontana, reporter at Wall Street Journal. I'll be sure and tweet the story that you can find at Wall Street Journal all about this, and we'll keep an eye and keep turning to you as this story continues to unfold and we see more of this in the workplaces. Thanks so much for being with us today, Francesca.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and we come back, we are going to be talking about Wells Fargo and the aftermath of that scandal we talked about a while back of all these accounts. Remember that? Well, it's hit some credit scores. So we're going to be talking about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots of people walking by enjoying the sunshine out here on Michigan Avenue, and I'm sure lots of people headed out to the Air and Water Show. We will keep you updated on that every half hour, the top and bottom of every hour, of course. So joining us now on the program is Renee Merle, regular contributor to this show for sure. She is a reporter covering white-collar crime and Wall Street for Washington Post. And she wrote about how Wells Fargo is dealing with the aftermath of that scandal. Remember, we talked about that? The scandal that was brought about by the creation of millions of fraudulent savings and checking accounts on behalf of Wells Fargo clients without their consent. Remember all that? That was big, big news when that happen. And of course, there is fallout from that. And so joining us now to talk about that is Renee Merle. Welcome back to the program, Renee.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Thanks for being with us and appreciate you taking time out of your weekend for us. So talk us through what is the latest with this issue with Wells Fargo, because I know that after all these fraudulent accounts were created, they didn't just go away after the story surfaced. There are real life ramifications for these customers that it impacted. So tell us about that, if you would.
Well, one of the lingering impacts, I consider almost collateral damage, is that for these customers, in some cases, Wells Fargo opened a credit card that they didn't want or a bank account, and they accumulated late fees or maintenance fees that they didn't even know. And as a part of that, they took a hit to their credit score. I talked to one customer who saw their credit score go down by 100 points because they had a credit card they didn't want that accumulated almost $1,000 worth of fees over a year. And now they're trying to figure out how to, you know, restore their credit score now and, you know, get back, be compensated for the inconvenience of all of that.
Wow, that is very significant. 100 points on your credit score, that can cost you a great deal of money, and that can be the difference between getting a loan or not. That's really significant. So what responsibility does Wells Fargo have to these customers? It would seem like quite a bit, but if these things are happening, then perhaps they're not not settling up in quite the way that they should be.
Well, Wells Fargo acknowledges that this is a problem, and they say that, you know, they've just never, no one has ever had to deal with this sort of thing before. So they're trying to come up with formulas on how to compensate people. And they're trying to, you know, use those formulas based on if you try to buy a house while your credit score is impacted by one of these credit cards or bank accounts that you didn't want, and then you ended up paying a higher interest rate for that loan, or if you got denied a loan, how much do you compensate for those people? But it's, you know, this is totally new territory. And so it's taking a long time. A lot of people are becoming frustrated because how do you compensate for somebody, you know, even a 10-point drop in your credit score can mean thousands of dollars over a period of time, or just, you know, let's not forget that credit scores are not just used for getting a loan, but your employers look at it. If you're going to rent a home or rent an apartment, if the landlord looks at your credit score, it impacts so many little things that you don't even think about on a daily basis. So how do you compensate somebody, not just for the extra cost that they're paying, but the inconvenience and sometimes embarrassment?
Sure, certainly. Well, and we're talking about compensation here. Is there, do you get a sense that there's any movement towards, because this is so unprecedented and such a unique situation, is there any sense of perhaps working with the big credit bureaus like TransUnion and Equifax and Experian to work out something of specific to the people who have been impacted by this Wells Fargo issue?
Well, Wells Fargo, of course, has been sued several times over this. And I know that in at least one of the cases that they're trying to settle right now, they have engaged with the credit bureaus to try to address this and try to figure out what Wells Fargo did impacted the person's credit score. But as you know, as anybody knows, these credit bureaus are almost like a black box. It's really hard to determine how they weigh these things and, you know, how much one change, one ding on your credit report can impact your credit score. So it's like a complex process, but they are definitely trying to engage with the credit bureaus. But they're independent companies. They're, you know, they're not even government agencies. They're independent companies, and they can do what they want.
Well, it is really interesting to me how far-reaching this is. And so what are kind of the next steps that we can expect to see on the horizon as this continues to roll on?
Well, I think that, you know, right now Congress is on break. And, as you know, Wells Fargo just took another hit from all of this. The issue with the unauthorized accounts came up last September, but just last month they acknowledged that they had charged about 500,000 customers for auto insurance they didn't need. And in thousands of cases, people ended up losing their cars, having their cars repossessed because of that. So that's compounding, you know, the image problem Wells Fargo already had, but it's actually adding to the complexity of the credit score problem, because obviously a repossession, that's like having a foreclosure on your credit score. That's really damaging to somebody. And how do you compensate somebody for that? So the next part of all this is that Wells Fargo has to figure out a formula, and they acknowledge this. They have to figure out a way to address this. We expect the regulatory agencies, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to weigh in at some point. And when Congress gets back after this August break, perhaps they will weigh in as well.
Very, very interesting. And it seems like this will be a very difficult thing for Wells Fargo to recover from, just with not necessarily people that were impacted by this, but just kind of general consumer trust. This seems like very, and because we have this second beat to it with this auto insurance issue, what steps is Wells Fargo taking at this point to try to rebuild that kind of consumer trust, other than trying to compensate people who were impacted? But what about, you know, recruiting and maintaining future customers?
Well, the part of the problem for Wells Fargo also is that the number of new accounts and customers have taken a hit in that way. They're still obviously a very profitable bank, but they just, they have definitely apologized, and they do so repeatedly. They actually just announced that they're going to have a new board. They hired a new person, someone else to chair their board of directors. So they're trying to shake things up and to give not necessarily customers, but at least shareholders, confidence that they're going in a new direction. And other than that, the only thing that can really address this is them fixing it, hoping that there's not another shoe to drop, and time.
Right, right. It seems like it might be a lengthy process. Well, we will keep turning to you at Washington Post for the latest as this continues to add interesting twists and turns to it. Renee Merle, thank you so much for being with us again today on the program.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and get you turned over to Scott Catoon with the Startup Showcase here in just a bit here on 720 WGN.